Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 328th episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Sean Wisniewski and Mark Hicks. Today, we're visiting with Jeff Hamilton of Hamilton Toolworks, maker of exquisite marking gauges and other fine tools. So welcome to the show, Jeff.
Hi,
guys. Yeah, before we get to talking with Jeff, let's go into some woodworking news. So first off, Lee Valley has, I guess they're now selling a Hirsch large number 3 straight gouge for $49. And I looked at this strictly from a chair maker's perspective for knocking off the tops of tenons as they come through the chair seat. And this looked like a very nice tool to do that at only $49, which is probably cheaper than I spent on the chisel I use. I think mine's one of those Swiss-made fell ones, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Now you just answered my question as you were describing what, because I was going to ask, what do you use a large number 3 straight gouge for? I understand it's a very, very shallow sweep, but the number 3, is that it's not a 3-inch circle, like cut out. It's some, like how they grade those.
Yeah. I'm not sure what those sweeps mean. I don't know. Anybody, Mark, do you have any idea?
No, I don't. Yeah. I think each maker tends to have their own system sometimes, but
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so this blade is 1/9/16 wide.
Yeah.
And it exactly. has a shallow number 3 sweep, whatever that means. I know it's shallow, but were you saying that's you're trimming your tenons as it's coming into a seat area? That makes sense because it's a curved. Seat, yeah. Okay. That's. Yeah,
what about like the number 5?
Does it go shallower or steeper?
No, it's steeper and it's bent.
I know Bar Tools sells one that's fairly highly regarded, but it's like it's over $100.
Okay.
For the one.
Yeah, is Hirsch I'll say it in the kindest way, budget brand? Or
I'm not that familiar with carving tools, but they're fairly well known out there. I don't know.
Yeah, I've heard of them for sure.
Yeah, I don't know where they are in the actual hierarchy. I know, those Fell Swiss made ones seem to be, carving tools seem to be the gold standard. I think there are some that are better than that, but I think you pay for it, but
looking just at their general gouges, lineup, there's a lot of, not quite that big. Those are all in that price range, but I mean, you can spend $60 on a number 7 bent gouge. Mm-hmm. But you're right. I mean, at $50 or so, that if you say that's cheaper than something else, as long as the metal is equal and it's going to sharpen about the same and last about as long.
Yeah.
You don't use it very often, so I mean, it's just if you can get it sharp enough to take the top off of 4 chair legs and go back and sharpen it again.
Right.
The Bar Tools one is 128.
Right.
Ooh, it's hand forged. I mean, it's a whole different.
Yeah.
A whole different system.
So the hand forged might be worth more, but as long as you don't have to sharpen the other one 4 times to 1.
Yeah.
What I've heard about Bar's chisels is they're really excellently made.
Yeah.
It's really good steel. So I'm sure it's worth the extra amount there, but if you're looking for something that's more budget friendly, I don't think you could go much better than that at $50 for one. So because it looks like it has a lot of mass behind it, which makes that task relatively easier. The one I use, the Swiss made one, it's a nice one. It does a good job, but it doesn't have the mass that this thing looks like it has. So I don't know. Maybe I'll pick one up and let you know.
There you go.
But I just thought I'd throw that out there. Also, Lee Valley, in their quest to miniaturize everything, has come out with a Veritas miniature bench vise. So for $39.50, $40, and it is pretty darn cute.
Yeah. So now are we looking at for a series of 20 to $45 purchases from Lee Valley, you can build a quarter scale workbench and tool set, right?
Exactly.
It seems like everything is in that price mark, right around in that range. And so do you want a quarter scale bullnose plane, or do you know, but now a bench vise that you need to turn with just an index and thumb grip, you know, to spin it around.
Well, if you made a little shop with all these little things and you had all those tools, and what's that hobby maker's power tool, Proxon or something like that?
Mm.
You know what I'm talking about? Those little tiny bandsaws and table saws and stuff like that. I think it's Proxon or something like that. But they're made for hobbyists making small stuff. And they're small little table saws, small bandsaws. I think they have a lathe. I think they have all kinds of interesting things. But you could really put together a interesting shop with all this stuff anyway. Okay, yeah. I'm not sure where I'm going there, but I went there. So.
Well, I think I'm going to, you know, make a downsized version of the bench-crafted molds and start making, you know, quarter-scale Roubaix foot-top workbenches. It'd be a lot easier to ship, you know.
Yeah.
Same on you.
Market for me.
Oh, man. You might actually get some sales out of quarter-inch stuff. I mean, can you quarter-scale stuff. Can you imagine? Holy. Yeah, that
it
could be.
It would ship in, like, a standard, you know, you know the box ships free kind of thing. way less than 300 pounds. Like, how about that?
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. Well, let's move right along. So, got a couple of new things from Harvey Tools. They have a new sliding table for your table saw, and they've also come out with a router table that also can either stand alone, or I think it's primarily designed to be one of the wings on a table saw. And both of these accessories attached on not only their saws, but a number of people's saws, including SawStop and Paramatic and Grizzly and whatnot. So it looks, you know, I looked at the price range. It looks like pretty much a direct competitor to what SawStop has done, as well as for their router tables and sliding tables, about the same price. I think
SawStop licensed the design to them. I don't
really.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it, and it is exactly like the one I already have.
Really?
They changed the color on a few of the anodizing on some of the parts, but other than that.
It looks similar, and I noticed the price range was similar, too. So, you know, it could be that Harvey is the one that's making the – I know Harvey – I know the company, whoever their parent company is. It's a Chinese company, but I know they make a lot of these saws and stuff for a lot of manufacturers. So, you know, you're probably right on point there. They might even make the saw stop itself. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the cabinets are the same. Yeah. There's a lot of similarities. They don't have the stop.
Yeah.
In your saws though, do they?
No, no.
Yeah. Other than that, they look exactly the same.
Yeah.
They're slick, you know, for sure. I mean, they look good. And Mark, if you say the saw stop works well, I mean, that's a good.
It's good for what I do.
Yeah.
It doesn't excel at, like, I wouldn't buy it for a cabinet shop, but SawStop has a new one that's a lot bigger that would do the job.
Yeah.
Much better. So, yeah, I mean, for what I use it for, I use it a lot with my dado blade to cut tenons and to just, you know, I guess they call it a speed tenon. But rather than have a tenoning jig for a 4-foot long rail, I just, you know, cut all four sides with the dado blade. And having that big fence and a slider that is really smooth makes that easy.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. So this might be a way of them introducing SawStop, introducing the slider and the router table for other table saws out there.
Yeah, maybe so.
So, if y'all are interested in getting that, and especially if you own a SawStop, you might want to see which one you can get cheaper at the given point in time. And I know Harvey does, they have an introductory offer on both of these right now, and they do sales quite often. If you get on their mailing list, I probably get an email every day, it seems like, from them on some sort of flash sale they have on some of their stuff. So check that out. And speaking of Harvey Tools, they also, a subsidiary of them, it's also Bridge City Toolworks. And they've come out with something that I thought was kind of interesting. And it's the PP-1 Pencil Precision. So it's a pencil maker. You know, they have the chopstick maker. So now they have a pencil maker. and you can make several different types of pencils, and they will sell you all the accessories. And it comes in at a rocking price of introductory price, should I say, of $700. So I don't know how many pencils you would have to make to get a good return, but probably quite a few.
Yeah. I mean, it is, I don't know what the market is. I don't know how many artisanal pencil makers there are out there.
There are a lot more now.
Well, yeah. This really does seem almost tongue in cheek. It's over engineered for a not so necessarily precision job.
Yeah.
Or necessarily something that you want to do by hand. The chopstick thing was the same thing though.
Yeah, you know, that's like, what I was about to say.
You know, I can make some chopsticks for somebody who's an enthusiast for a gift one time. I don't see that as a mass market thing, so I don't know where they ever went that way. But I love their stuff. It's all beautiful. I love the detail. I love the engineering. I just don't know.
Yeah, and one of the things that I thought was interesting is it kind of competes with Andy Klein's pencil maker that he came out with, what, a year or so ago?
Yeah, was it?
Yeah, I think so, something like that. His, I checked the prices on his real quickly, and it seemed to be a little bit less expensive. So,
a little
if you're
bit.
Dying to make a pencil, you might want to compare the two. I don't know if one has more options and features than the others, but it probably
it
would.
It doesn't come with a plane.
Yeah, that's true. It does not come with a plane. There so, yeah. So, you know, anyway, but it's kind of interesting. But moving right along, so let's go with what's in the shop. So, Mark, what are you working on?
Well, I am working on a batch of shave horses to end up the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I just unwrapped a HNT Gordon vise set from Heartwood Tools.
Oh, so, nice.
So, yeah, I am I'm looking forward to testing that out. It's going to be fun.
Is this for a customer or is this for you?
It's R&D, so I get to write it off.
But, there you go.
Yeah, no, it's going to stay here in the shop. I have an idea of where I'm going to put it. It'll help me test, you know, how I would install it if I did use it for a customer.
Yeah, is this the one? Is this their pattern makers one or the straight?
I just got the straight standard one. I have a pattern makers vise and I haven't needed it enough to actually install it. So I figured I could save $1,000 or whatever it costs difference is. But and then I got one of the tail vices, and I think that's going to be really nice. there's a lot of people who aren't sure whether they want a tail vise or not, and I tell them that they'll be fine without it. Mm-hmm. But they haw and they eventually end up buying the tail vise, which is fine with me. But I think this might be an option for people who think they could get by without it, but if they realize they've screwed up, they can just install this little tail vise in their bench. And it's a better solution than like the Veritas bench dog that has a clamp on it, you know?
Yeah. But
I want to see how it holds. So I'm interested to see how that.
I'm interested. Yeah. Cause I used to have a tail vise and then I decided I didn't need it. So I took it out. But it was just it was nothing special. It's just a quick release clamp on the tail and, never used it. So I took it out and then I found myself wanting something, so something like this might have fit the bill. I went ahead and installed that Veritas surface vise thing that you kind of route in and it kind of acts like a tail vise.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yep. Yeah, and that's worked fine for me. I don't really use a tail vise that often, but when I need to, that seemed to work fine for me. But something like this is probably a little bit better than that. And especially if you know, the one thing about that Veritas solution is if you ever had to flatten your bench, you might have to keep lowering this thing down and down and down.
That's true. Mark, with it in your hands, I mean, does it look like it's, or I guess with your tooling too, is it easy enough to install this thing? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's, let me open
looks pretty straightforward.
Cardboard up, but yeah, I mean, it's, I think you route an opening for the top plate, so that's where you get around having to lower the vise in the bench. Mm-hmm. You have to flatten your bench. I think it's like a quarter inch top plate that goes on it.
Okay, yeah, that gives you plenty of room.
While I'm opening it. I didn't open the tail vise up from now, so.
Oh, look at
the unboxing.
Yeah, this is our first unboxing podcast.
Isn't it exciting audio?
Good for audio.
Yeah, I mean, it's man, this thing is just like dead simple. It's just a square tube, you know, and with some brass stuff on the inside. Yeah, and a knob on the end.
So in that case, I mean, it's unlike other things where there's, you know, other tail vices where there's a big exposed screw, an Acme screw or some sort. You know, this is really self-contained, right? I don't know about, I can't tell, is that end. Like, you're literally just twisting it with your thumb, right? To do this clamping.
It's a little bit more than an inch diameter. It's a pretty...
Okay, so a grip. So it's a hand grip.
Yeah, and it's so textured really nicely.
Okay. I just wonder about, like, you know, the elderly that as arthritis starts kicking in, does that hinder the operation of something like this?
I don't know. I certainly don't think you'll have issues, like, if your hands are wet during a glue-up or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to slip in your hand. It's got, you know, it's got pretty good grip texture on it. And you don't use your fingers. I mean, you can use your fingers. You know, this thing is bigger than one of those, well, smaller than a Gatorade lid.
Mm-hmm.
But much bigger than, you know, a regular soda bottle.
Oh. Yeah, so you're going to use your bigger, palm.
I guess it's hard to say in the image I'm looking at.
Yeah, let me find a tape measure in a shop. I don't have a tape measure.
Vice body, 32 by 35.
Inch and a quarter, 32 millimeters probably.
Yeah,
so diameter.
I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And the body of the vise is about an inch and a quarter square. And I got the shorter length one because Leslie didn't have the big ones in stock at the time. But there's nothing to it. I mean, it doesn't even have a screw to attach it to your bench. You just drop it down into a groove and screw a wooden plate down over the top of it and route an opening for the dog to slide in, and you're done. Yeah. I mean, it's all the screws that hold that plate down go into the wood.
Interesting.
There's one screw in the hardware pack, and it's a metal screw. So I don't know. I'll have to read the instructions. Give you an update next week.
Yeah, it looks it's simplistic in its design. You're the bench builder. I'm curious to hear what you think about it, having worked with other vices. And this is an option. I think, you know, again, self-contained, incredibly simple in installation. How effective in use, like you said, like how well does it clamp? You know, to somebody who's just doing hard, just driving cross grain planing. You know, does it? You know, you've got a scrub plane on there taking just thick, you know, chops out. Does this thing rack? Does it whatever? If it's not held down, really, it's captive. But you know. I'm just curious. I've heard about it before. We've talked about it before. Now that you've got one in shop, now we'll have somebody to talk about it directly.
Right.
Yeah. So I was looking at the bottom. There is one screw, and that is what keeps the vise. And there's a little brass tab. And that's what keeps the vise from pushing out the back end of the bench when you tighten it down on something.
Okay.
So that is a small concern.
So you got to drop another. You route out you have the recess for the lid, the quarter inch lid that covers it all. You got the recess for the body of the thing too, but then you've got to recess another little travel, another route down below that to for that thing to slide back and forth. Which
so the sliding part is totally internal to the vise. You need a cavity for the vise, a cavity for the wooden plate that covers it, and then you need something under the pathway to let the dust fall through.
Oh, is that what that is? I see the extra hole.
Yeah, but so my concern is there's not a lot holding this vise, keeping it from ejecting itself as you crank it down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that'll be something that I'll have to see if I can make it fail and see what that takes.
Yeah.
It's retrofittability, which is pretty obvious. I mean, you could put this in pretty much any slab of wood and call it a vise.
Yep.
Pretty quickly, you know, with just a guide and a router, you're
little bits for the hole on the bottom. Yeah, you don't even have to make it pretty. It just needs to be bigger than the groove in the vise body. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I
I'm interested to see how that turns out.
That's, yeah, me too. I'm looking forward to trying
it. Cool.
It.
So I noticed you also finished up some projects right on time.
Yeah, I managed to deliver the desk and the rocking chair by Christmas morning. Well, the desk on Christmas morning, like in the dark.
Yeah. Just don't touch the top for another 24 hours.
Yeah, like let it off.
Well,
gas.
It was Osmo, and I put it on at 8 o'clock the night before. So, but it wasn't a surprise. He knew that was coming.
Yeah.
The rocking chair was supposed to be a surprise, but he took it upon himself to come out to the shop and tell me that dinner was ready one night after he was told not to come into the shop anymore, and walked right in on me painting it. And he's like, oh, is that my rocking chair? So,
I mean, was he claimed
that chair shortly after I brought it home, and it's been sitting forever waiting to get painted. So
is that the one we made at Greg's?
Yes, in 2017.
Mine still doesn't have paint either.
Well, I can
show you. Got kicked out of the living room because it made grooves in the wood floor.
Ooh, well. Anyway, well, you did do a good job on it. I like the colors too. That was
my first pinstriping job.
Yeah.
So I was pleased with how it turned out. Not the best, like, you know, best job, but certainly the best I could do at the time. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, fantastic. Well, so Sean, what have you been working on?
Working on not much. As we're recording, we're just after the Christmas holiday.
Yeah.
I did get the Rockler drill guide, the nice blue and black anodized tiltable, you know, kind of drill guide.
Yeah, I bought one of those just to test it out. It's in the bag, but yeah, it's pretty nice.
I was just going to ask you, how did you find it? I personally don't have a drill press.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my time,
it would be perfect for that.
Yeah, I mean, so like I've drilled bench holes in my bench.
Yeah.
With a Forstner bit and a handheld drill. I hope to hell they were straight. You know, I did my best.
Yeah.
And it's just one of those things. And it was like, you know, I know this is out there. So, you know, I asked my dad for it and he got me one. It's not as smooth in its travel as I think it could be. And maybe that's just newness, or maybe that's just normal, because I chucked two different drills on it. And while I could drill, and I was only drilling like a 5/16 hole.
Mm-hmm.
And I, with my smaller drill, the bite it had on the actual shaft of the drill or the chuck, I could not lift the whole apparatus up its rails out of the drilled hole. I couldn't back it back out. I'm like, what the hell? And then my dad actually gave me a spring, a real loose coil spring to try to assist that.
Mm-hmm.
And while it's a spring in the way, it limits the downward travel, but it could, that the spring didn't help at all. Like, you know, it was just a little, and I don't know if it was just sticky. There's like an O-ring in those things that are sliding up and down slightly greased rails.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Well, what I found is when I tested the one I had, and I had the same issues that you're describing, is those two bars that the carriage rides up and down on can get out of whack ever so slightly. So
that's
you might want to just try to move those a little bit, and it should free it up where it slides better.
Yeah, because that's the crazy. Because I did.
Yeah, now it is way better built than
I've taken
anything.
The whole thing off.
Yeah, it is way better than anything else out there that's like that. Those cheapo drill guides that they sold for years and years and years. This is way better than that. But yeah, it has its limitations.
Yeah, I mean, my dad was like, I have one, but it was his dad's. It's some old Black and Decker thing from the '60s, you know, and it doesn't do any angles. And I don't know if I'll ever do angles. And my primary concern is to just go straight down. I want a perpendicular hole as most I can make it. And it appears to be able to do that. It's just, you know, just learning about it. And, you know, first time use, I just kind of put it on the thing and try to drill a hole and went, okay, it's okay. But you're right. I mean, it is two independent roughly posts. And so how they, you know, they might be just slightly askew and might just muck that all up. I totally understand that. And I mean, I don't, I don't know how an easy way to check that other than like just laying them both down on the surface and hoping that they both hit at the same time with some certainty.
Now, the one I had, it would not go to a full 90 degrees at the D10 or whatever it was. I forgot what it was now. It was
The company doesn't have 90 degrees, does it?
Well, I'm sorry. 90 degrees to your surface.
It wouldn't go all the way up, really.
Yeah, it was off by a couple of degrees, at least according to my measurements, but I don't know. So you might want to double check that. If you're in the market, you could have bought one of my boring jigs. It would do everything you need.
Man, you are so right. You know, and honestly, I probably should have. That would have been
I would give you the friends and family discount.
I know. And then my dad would have your email and all those things. It'd be fun.
Yeah.
So zero is upright. Zero is 90 degrees.
Yeah.
And it has no detents, but like markings to go down.
Right. Maybe it was that. I don't know. I just found mine the one I had. Of course, I bought it when they were brand spanking new just to see how it compared to my boring jig.
Right.
And I noticed it wasn't straight on 90 degrees, but
yeah. And it's a little bigger than I kind of thought it.
But of course, you know, if you're primarily doing 90 degrees, you're drilling straight down, my boring jig does require a little bit more setup than what this would, just because mine's mainly made to drill at angles.
Right.
Yeah.
This is it. But it's strange to hold it. Like if I can, I'm literally holding this thing in my hand, suspending it by its rails.
Yeah.
And it just released. It's that kind of fight. It falls okay, but it won't come back up.
Have you lubricated them?
No, I haven't. I mean, it's like the stock lubrication. There's oil on it.
Yeah. Huh. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Just some, new tool, new toy.
Yeah.
I'm gonna play with it. It's nice and robust. It's heavy. It's good. I mean, it was crazy.
I thought the build quality was a lot better than other stuff out there on the market. That's for sure.
It is. It really is. And I mean, the box it came in was like, it was the simplest shipping box I had ever seen. It's robust as hell. It's like two layers, a quarter inch cardboard folded all over the place. Mm-hmm. And it was all assembled side, except for the two handles on the side.
Yeah. Did you get the little parts holder? They have a little drill vise that fits into it.
Parts holder?
Yeah, it's like a little drill vise that'll fit into it. It's an accessory for it.
No. So this is just the standard kind of.
Okay. All right. Just wondering.
Yeah. Yeah.
No. Well, if you want one of those, just let me know. I might have one.
Okay.
I thought I might use it for something else. I never have. So.
I mean, I don't know. Like I asked for this thing. I got it, and I then got it home and went, where the hell did I put it when I'm not using it? Because it's kind of big-ish. Mm-hmm. It's bigger than a cereal box, and it's heavier than that too. So I had it on the floor, I just under the bench, and I don't have a great place. But yeah, it's but I mean, otherwise it's good. I mean, that was my big woodworking thing I've got, but really all I've done is test it so far.
Well, cool. Yeah.
I mean, it is. It's a neat addition, and like I said, I'm the hand tooled guy that doesn't have a drill press, which is such a useful tool.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about this is the size of it. Once you get a drill on it and you're pushing down, it's almost, I need it almost lower than my bench height to get down on it. It's just because it's got some height to it.
Yeah.
And it's somewhat concerning. I'm gonna have to play with that and see like what I can do. I actually ended up, I drilled it just to do some quarter inch material right on my bench. Right. And I made a hole in my bench be like the receiving end of the drill.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't drilling into the bench, but otherwise it's 12 inches high. It's not hugely high, but say you get a drill on that thing and now you're at its highest point. You might be at shoulder height, and that doesn't give you a mechanical advantage to push down at all.
Right. Yeah. And all of those, even my boring jig is susceptible to that because of basically what you're trying to do. You got to get it high enough to, especially for clearance for, larger drill bits and being able to get it for mine, get it certain angles. But then you're always going to have some sort of rod, that you got to punch through. So yeah, height's always going to be an issue with those things. Yeah.
And as I'm reminded every time I'm around my kids, I'm a short human being.
Me too.
So I have that to deal with.
Yeah, and if you have a low bench, that would be good to.
Well,
to,
and that's what I wonder. Like my bench is literally
if you have a door on
sawhorses.
Yeah, sawhorses. Yeah, you got some sort of Well, what's the word I'm looking for? Those little saw benches.
Saw benches. And I do. I've got a pair of saw benches. So, and that might be better because it's more like knee height. And I can get down on something. It's what I can saw on, literally, you know, with a handsaw. And that might fit a lot better for me. If I was 6 feet something, it might work better on my current bench. But
if you were 6 feet something, your bench would probably be taller. So
that's true. True. You're right.
Well, good, good. So anyway.
Yeah. What about you, man? What do you got going on?
I got a whole bunch of stuff going on. It's not been a quiet holiday season for me. So, Reamer update. We're actually going to finally go to market, I hope, and manufacture the 6-degree all-metal Reamers. Mm-hmm. I know I've been kind of teasing that for a while, but I've been working with Sean Murphy, who currently makes some nice 11-degree Reamers. And I've been working with him on designs. And, I mean, we're into the nitty gritty of it. We're sitting there going back and forth on eighths of an inch and 32nds of an inch here and whatnot. So we got the design all nailed down. And I think this week he's contacting his guys to get these made. So I'm hoping, you know, they got to manufacture them and all of that. But I'm hoping maybe a month or two we'll actually have them ready to go. So, keep your eye out. He put a post up, I put a post up, and I think we've had close to probably at this point, 35 folks say they're definitely interested in it. And hopefully there'll be a few more. And I think we're going to have enough to satisfy this initial demand, but it's really great. And, you know, to kind of highlight what you can do with my boring jig, I think a couple of days ago, I posted me drilling and reaming a couple of holes using the Lee Valley jig. So,
And you posted that and I saw there was like a point one-ish, you know, variance between.
Yeah,
I'm guessing that's exact enough for what you do, correct?
Oh yeah, yeah, that's warning. Well, especially since I think I was off between the three holes. I think I was off maybe. I think one was like 0.5 degrees under, one was 1 degree over, and one was right on. And the error on the actual gauge is 0.1 degree. So I was within the error of the gauge.
And the alternative without the gauge with smoke and mirrors, I'm sure isn't that tight. So.
Yeah, no. You know, I mean, we're talking chair making here. You got quite a lot of wiggle room, but I'm impressed with the accuracy of being able to do it. And, you know, you can drill and ream a hole in under 2-3 minutes. So, I mean, you can't ask for more than that. And I have a new way, I think, of actually doing a depth stop on it so that you're always reaming. You know, I like to ream my holes to 15/16 of an inch at the large diameter of the ream hole. And I think I still need to experiment, and I'll have to probably do that once I get these reamers in. But I think I got a way to put a depth gauge on the boring jig, so it makes it even more foolproof. So you don't have to keep looking down and checking, making sure where you are on that mark. We'll see how that goes. So. And then besides that, I do have a new jig I've been working on. And, to give you just a little bit, it's basically a jig that will allow you easily to drill holes in arms and bows, you know, where you got to do that spindle from the seat into the bow or the arm. And I've been working on it for a long time. And I think, Sean, I know you saw one of my prototypes. And what's interesting is I'm not quite ready to announce all the details of it yet, but it'll be coming soon. But JMAW Works, however you want to pronounce that, J Mallworks or something like that. But Jeremy over there, he's actually an engineer, and he's working on a chair, and he came up with a jig that was kind of similar to the concept I had. He kind of at me in his post, and I went, "Hey, I'm already there. I'm already working on that." So it was kind of fun. But I figured since I said that, I might as well just go ahead and announce it. Yes, I have a new jig coming out. So
there you go.
Yeah, and I just, I have a pre-production model that I've been doing some testing. Boy, probably the last 2 days, I've probably drilled over 100 holes just testing different configurations of it. But I think I have it all nailed down. And today I ordered all the parts for the actual pre-production model. So once I get those in and get that put together, I'll probably start posting on it. So probably within the month, because the place I'm ordering from takes about 2 weeks to ship. So once I get that and get that put together and tested, I'll probably start posting some more. But I'm hoping it'll be pretty good and fairly reasonable on cost-wise, too. So we'll see that.
That's good. That's awesome to see that you got things moving along.
Yeah. Yeah. There's only one more jig that I have in the back of my mind I really haven't started working on yet. So I think that's all I got so far. But hopefully that will be the, I'll have everything you need to build all kinds of different staked furniture and Windsors and whatnot. So we'll see. But, and then I did get a new air compressor.
Yeah, way to go.
Yeah, I got one of those California air compressors. I had one of those pancake ones. I'm not sure who the manufacturer was of it. It had Porter Cable written on the side of it, but, whatever.
Yeah, you never know.
But that one lasted like 12 years, which is not bad. But, yeah, I finally gave up the ghost. It was only pressurizing up to about 30 PSI before it would cut off and then cut on and then cut off and then cut on, cut off, cut on. So I said, okay, I got to get a new one. And I don't use air for much except for blowing stuff up and filling up the occasional tires. But I went ahead and got one of those California air compressors. And yeah, those things are dead quiet. Build quality seems to be fairly good. It's got an aluminum tank on it, which makes it a lot lighter than the pancake one. This one's a little bit larger. I think the pancake was 6 gallons and this one's 8 gallons. And, but the only thing is the on off switch is a little funky. It's just kind of a wire with a rubberized red tip on it that you move back and forth, kind of like an old switch,
Wow.
Really, that's not that. What?
I've got the same switch on mine.
Yeah. Oh, that's the only thing that kind of took me aback. I go, I wish I had a regular switch instead of.
And then you make me think about my pancake. I don't forget if it's a Milwaukee or Porter Cable or whoever, but it's it's a red button that I physically pull out or push in. Like it's a click, click. There's no guess.
Yeah. But that's the only thing that I thought was a little funky was the on off button, but it looks pretty good and seemed to have rave reviews. So Mark, you have one of the California Air ones?
No, I just have that same little wire switch. Mine also says Porter Cable on the side.
Oh, okay. Hmm.
It's an old 2-tank like job site, air nailer compressor.
Mm-hmm. So.
Oh yeah, you got the one with the wheel between the 2 tanks kind of.
No, it's just a small, it's got a big handle out the top. You just pick it up and carry it away.
Oh, okay. Mine's a true pancake. It's just a squat cylinder.
I think these came out right before those.
Okay.
Yeah. This one little compressor replaced like an 80-gallon vertical 5-horsepower compressor that I used to have in the shop. But I found out that I really don't need air if I'm not running sanders. So.
Yeah.
Well, the orbital sanders with air.
Like you said, I'm with Kyle. My compressor, it can run a nail gun, and it has, but mostly it's like just blowing off stuff, blowing out a filter that I'm working on or whatever, and it's just minimal.
Yeah, same way. I got a brad nailer and a stapler that I probably use it maybe once a year, but not even that, in jig making, I probably should pull it out and use it for that, but I find myself, where's my domino? Boom.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you had, what is it? Oh, no, Mercas are electric. I was saying the Merca Sander kind of blows away the, or is it the electric version of that, like, paddle handle Sander?
Yeah, you can run anything like that on. Yeah, you need the compressor that Mark used to have, the 80-gallon tank ones.
Yeah.
Even that one wasn't enough. I mean, it would run a lot if you were trying to run an air sander. But air sanders, you need them if you're going to sand all day. But you know, anybody who's just sanding occasionally to finish, you know, an electric, you know, especially those new brushless motor sanders, they're great sanders. I would stick with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My dad has an old like a horizontal tank compressor.
Mm-hmm.
But he's had it as long as I remember, and I remember him telling me a year or two ago that it almost started a fire, something blew on it electrically, and he rebuilt it, but damn, this tank still holds and whatever. But like same thing, like he's done nothing but filled tires with it for decades, you know, and it does well for him, but right. Yeah, it's just one of those things. Like, yeah, the one I have, I picked up because I needed it one day, and I've used it since, but it was $100 at the big box store. It's like, whatever, just get a thing.
And that's what I got. You know, it's like exactly. The pancake was $100. I was impressed with the California. It's only, it was 200 and something bucks. So it's only about $100 more. Mm-hmm. And man, that thing is, you know, yeah, you can carry on a conversation with that thing running. You know?
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Mine, I hear, I mean, it can be outside the garage when all doors closed and I still hear it hum. Like it's louder than hell.
Oh yeah, that's it would drive my wife crazy because I'd forget to turn it off. I'd be upstairs and all of a sudden the thing kicks on. She's like, go downstairs, turn that damn thing
off.
What
you doing? You know? Oh, it's just cycling air. Vibrating
the only problem is that this one, if I do that, it can run all night long and I would never know it.
Oh, so. You never know. Yeah.
But anyway, so, and then let's see, besides that, the coveted Adirondack chair that I was making a copy of, that's done and out of the shop, so that's good, and hopefully I'll get back onto the rocker, so we'll see.
Once you get your jig making out of the way, you can get back on the rocker.
Yeah, that's a problem, is I did a small batch to get some inventory, and I think my inventory is now gone. So I might have to make some more jigs. It's not a bad problem to have, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but enough of us yammering on. So, Jeff, what are you working on in the shop?
Well, currently I'm trying to knock out orders that were made that people expected to get there by Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Working on a lot of those, getting those out. A couple of Cocobolo panel gauges, you know, some fun stuff. And, then my big thing right now is I'm preparing for a new tool to arrive, and my shop is running out of real estate really quick.
Oh.
And so. So what are you getting,
or is it a secret?
No, I'm getting a new surface grinder.
Oh, okay.
I am sick of, I'm kind of tired of losing the tips of my fingers because of blades that aren't flat. And so I thought I would, instead of sending them out to get it custom ground, I thought, why not buy one? So,
exactly.
So I got one coming. It should be here next Tuesday. I'm really looking forward to it. But I had to do some serious shop clean out. And
Now, I'm not really familiar. I've seen surface grinders, but I'm not that familiar with them. So what kind of footprint do they take?
About a 5x5 foot area.
Okay.
And is this, I mean, again, I'm with Kyle. I don't know a ton about this stuff because I'm not a metal worker. Is this the spinning disc and the platen that kind of moves back and forth underneath it kind of style?
That's pretty much it, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, like a magnetic plate?
Yeah, it'll have a magnetic chuck and then a balanced grinding wheel. And depending on the surface, and you can go way overboard with this stuff. I'm really looking for, I want to do the fewest laps on a stone that I possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
I have done enough blades that when I quit, it's because there's a trail of blood on the stone. So, and Mark has seen it before. I'm serious.
Yeah.
It gets bad. So, you know, just those little blades, it gets so sharp. And I'm not talking about the beveled edge. I'm just talking about the slot. It gets so sharp. They'll slice you it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a heartbeat. So you got to be really careful with them. And
so the blade, like, I'm sorry, but I'm holding one of your gauges right in my hand. And that blade can't be a quarter inch wide. And it might be 3/4, maybe 5/8 of an inch tall.
They're 3/4 by 1/4 when I get them from the laser cutter.
Okay. Okay. There you go. There you go. So, and so will this allow you to just put a whole, a gross of them on this plate and have them all flattened at once?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So
that's kind of cool.
Big deal.
So what happens is, not to get too technical, but what really happens when they come out of the laser, there's a burr that's blown out the bottom. Okay.
Sure.
So I was sending them out to get commercially surface ground so I wouldn't have to do all this.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is they're just paying menial labor guys to do this. And so they don't pay attention to whether the burr is up or down. And so what was happening is half of them would be burr down. Others would be burr up. And so inevitably, I will pick the side that is not flat. And as soon as you're committed, as soon as you grind that bevel, you're committed. You can't reverse it.
Right.
And so right. I will always pick the side that has the little bitty, and we're talking like thousandths of an inch here. But yeah. It's enough that when you're polishing on the stone, guess what?
Yeah.
You get that, you got a mirror finish, and then all of a sudden you got this cloudy area. And it's like, you want to just choke somebody. So my deal is, you know, when you run into that situation, I can sit there and just spin that thing on the stone, or I can say, set that sucker aside and I'll take those to the surface grinder. And so that's kind of what I'm looking at for that.
Mm-hmm.
But
are you grinding these like literally fingertip back and forth one at a time?
Yes. I use oil stones because water stones will not hold up to those things. So I primarily use oil stones, and I flatten every one of those by hand.
Hmm.
And that gets kind of a, like I said, after a couple of days of doing that, you don't do anymore for a while. So.
Ooh, I can imagine.
So, okay. You know, if you can get a tool that will not completely remove that step, but lessen the amount of swirls or figure eights that you got to make on your stone, the better off you are.
Mm-hmm. Now, you prefer oil stones to something, you said you prefer it to water stones, but I was thinking diamond plates or something like that. You prefer the oil stones to that?
What I found on the diamond plates,
mm-hmm.
the diamonds are held in a nickel medium
in the
stone, okay? So I'm actually rubbing something on those diamonds that's harder than that nickel. And so next thing you know, I have wore out more diamond plates trying that than I want to even say. But so what I found is flatten your stones with your diamond plates,
mm-hmm.
on your blades, on your oil stone. It just works a lot better. And you just find that I can do maybe 3 blades before I have to flatten my stones again. And what you're doing is when you address the stones with that diamond plate, you're opening up, you know, more facets on the stone, and it sharpens so much better. But what I found, like on water stones, it'll cut a groove so fast in that water stone that you're just wasting your money. It destroys the stone so fast that it's not economical at all.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of the burr?
I know. I think it's that small blade.
Yeah.
I think it just, if you're using a wider face, like a 3/4 inch chisel, you're not going to have the same effect as that 1/4 inch wide, 3/4 inch long blade.
Mm-hmm.
That thing is literally just chewing that stone to pieces as it goes across it.
Yeah, it's so small. The pressure is very small.
You know,
it's not spread out very far.
You really don't realize what it's doing until you look at your stone that was 1 inch thick, and now you got to throw it away because it's down to 3/8 of an inch, right? So, it just destroys stones. And I mean, they're heat treated to a Rockwell 60, 62. It's right in the middle, probably more like a 61, but they are so hard. And I did that for a reason. I wanted them to retain that edge, but they just destroy stones. That's kind of the reason you got to step it up a notch and go with a surface grinder. And, possibly even looking at a lapping machine after that. That's getting way outside of the woodworking world, but tool making is a different story. So,
right.
Absolutely. And so it's just crazy that your tooling is quarter by three quarter in plates of steel.
Yeah, that is pretty interesting. Well, listen, I'm sure we got 1,000 questions for you, but Jeff, I met you years ago. I think Sean did too at one of the Woodworking in Americas, and you were so kind enough to sell us some of your marking gauges. Yeah,
absolutely.
Thank you, guys.
Which are fantastic.
Do you remember? And then Jeff, I don't know if it was the first thing you did or what, but I remember you demonstrating it, and honestly, it's probably the reason I bought one. But you were scoring, you know, just the line. It was like, hey, I set it here and just draw it across, and look, I can let go of it, and it stays right there. And it was the way the bevel and the face of it fight, you know, each other to hold the thing in place. And I was like, damn, that's nice.
That the blade is pretty much the secret to the whole thing.
Sure.
And not to step off too far, but I'll tell you a little story. We were at a Woodworking in America conference, and Frank Klaus just happened to be there. And he walked by the booth, and he picked up one of my traditional marking gauges, and he's looking at it. And he's telling me that what I need to do is take my blade off and slide a piece of paper behind the, not the forward edge, but the reverse edge. So you tilt that blade at about a 2-degree angle. And so he's sitting there, and he's telling me this whole story. You know, the guy, when he talks, he brings in a crowd. It's inevitable. And so my butt's getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And I mean, I am nervous as hell. And this guy is just, he's going on about how I need to, you know, cant my blade to an angle so it will track true. And then he turns it over and looks at it. And he goes, forget everything I said.
Ooh.
He said, what you've done here is copied a Philister scoring blade or a Philister knicker. Is what he actually called it. And so to not go too far, but when I was grinding those blades, what I was trying to do was around that 1/4-inch radius, I wanted to do a perfect grind all the way around that. Well, that's impossible. You can't do that by hand.
Right.
And so what I ended up doing was I created a fingernail grind on that blade because it's round. So it's not only round across the radius on the end, but it's also round across the face. Mm-hmm. And so what we found was when you address that to a piece of wood and you pull it into it, it fights against the fence. But it's not really a fight. What it's doing is it pulls the fence tighter to the workpiece.
Exactly. It acts as a natural wedge.
Yes, it creates a wedge. And so therefore, whether the grain is running at a 45-degree angle or whatever, it don't care. It's still going to track true to the edge because it can't help it. It's just fighting that the whole time. So when you're pulling that gauge to make your line, it's actually pulling that fence tight, keeping your line straight, and it doesn't track the grain. That's something our forefathers figured out many, many years ago, and I found by complete accident. But
for sure,
it's really neat. I have a grinder that's set up to do it. It's all done by hand, and somehow I'm able to do it and more or less copy that grind every time, and it's pretty neat.
Heck yeah! I mean, again, sold me. I've got the 6-inch curly maple version of it. And
I think I went with the small one, though. Is that the 4-inch? Yeah.
And those things are sized for your hand. And, you know, a lot of people thought that it was the 6-inch was to lay out a larger or a further from the edge line. It's not really what it's designed for. And we'll get into that later probably. But it was designed for a gentleman that had hands that were just huge. His fingers like sausages.
Right.
And so he grabs my little 4-inch gauge and it's like disappears. And I'm like, he said, can you make one a little larger? And I said, yeah. So I took it home and scaled it up and brought it back and showed the guy. And he liked it, but next thing I know, he's still using the little one. But that's what that was designed for, is these guys with big hands.
I mean, I don't have sausage fingers, but as I hold it in my hand, and I've got my thumb holding kind of the center bar and my finger kind of in the little cutout in the front, you know, the rest of my hand covers, you know, everything but the last half inch or so of the 6-inch.
Right.
You know? So, I think I did the same thing. I might have held the 4 and gone, I don't see it under my pinky. It's gone. You know, it's within my hand. And so just that was enough to just say that. No, I'm not going to mark a line probably 4.5 inches into a board. But, you know, the option's there.
The option's there if you need it. That's
sure.
Exactly. So tell us a little bit about Hamilton Woodworks and how y'all got started.
Well, I don't know if you guys remember back in the good old days. This is around 2005. There were message boards, and one of them was called Badger Pond. And that's kind of where I found out about what table saw to buy and so on and so forth. So I got on Badger Pond, and I found that I wanted either a Powermatic or a Jet table saw, and, you know, so on and so forth. And so I had all this equipment, and I could make any rectangle you could imagine. And, you know, and I could make cabinets. I could do anything like that, and had made all kinds of stuff. And one of the neatest things was when I learned out how to make cove molding on a table saw. I just thought that was the coolest dang thing. But but there was something missing. There was more to woodworking. There had to be. And so while I was on Badger Pond, there was I can't remember if it was just a message or an advertisement about Mark Adams School of Woodworking. And I caught the bug, and I decided that I needed to go. And I had a couple friends that were on Badger Pond that were in my, you know, at least in the county that I live in. And I tried to get those guys to go with me. And the school at the time was pretty pricey. About, you know, room and board plus the school was about $1,500. And so that wasn't cheap. And that was just his joinery class.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't get anyone to go. And so I had talked to my wife, and we decided it was probably a good thing for me to do. And so I went ahead and saved up my money and booked a class. And at the time, you couldn't, if you were not an existing student, you didn't get into the school. It was really, really hard. And so they had just started a joinery class for non-alumni students, and that which gave me a break to go. And so I got this tool list, and man, I went to Lowe's, and I went to Home Depot and True Value, you name it, to get my tools. And I thought I was prepared, ready to go. And they'd sent a flyer, and there was a gentleman by the name of Dante Deani that you could get a hold of him, and he was a student there, so he knew kind of the ins and outs and what tools you really needed and what you didn't. And so I got a hold of him and got, you know, some more tools and so on and so forth. And when I got to school, I found out all this crap I bought was not ready to use. And so we spent several hours sharpening chisels, you know, just making sure your squares were true, all this stuff that I thought was already done for you when you got it at the store, right? So to go on a little bit more into the story, we get to this joint in the class, and it was a trestled key joint. And I had bought a Japanese mortise and gauge that would work, and you could use it as a marking gauge or a mortise and gauge. It was a real nice gauge, but it was too big to lay this joint out. And so primarily that was the same for every student in the class. And Mark had said, Mark Adams was teaching the class, and he said, he showed this little marking gauge, and he said, if anyone in this class would be willing to make these things, I'll sell every one of them you can make. Well, I was the dummy that bit. And these tools were made by the Left Hand Tool Company. And the gentleman was getting older in age, and his family decided they didn't want to do anything with it no more. There wasn't that much interest in it, and so on and so forth. And so
we went through a long process, and I made a few of the gauges and I sent them to Mark, and I was waiting for his approval, whether we were going to, you know, go ahead with it or what. And I finally, about 3 weeks after I'd sent the tools to him, I got an email from him, and it was about 6 pages of email dissertation about this marking gauge and whether I'd be willing to sell it or not. And so I was like, shoot, yeah. And so I started out selling about 25 of these things a year. And that was until, so I started in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2008, I was invited to go to the Woodworking in America conference. And that was the very first one. It was in, what was the name of that little town in Kentucky?
Oh, Berea?
Berea, Kentucky. Thank you.
I didn't go to that one, but I remember it.
I remember it. Yeah, I wasn't
there. That was my first introduction into woodworking crazy people, just to put it real lightly, okay? I mean, there are some fanatics out there like you wouldn't believe. But I got introduced to some really, really nice people. Dave Jeske. I got to meet the maker of Type Mark, which was really exciting. That was Kevin is a really neat guy, and we had a discussion about laying out a joint, and I told him, put that gauge down and try mine. Oh man, it made him so mad, it was hilarious. But the meeting with Dave Jeske was the turnaround of my company, and I give him credit for a lot of things. But when I met Dave, he was looking for a marking gauge to sell with his chisels, and he didn't have time to develop his own, and he thought that mine fit the bill. The only problem was the finish, and he wanted a little brass. And at the time, I was using just an off-the-shelf brass nub. And mm-hmm. So he said, I need you to get a custom knob made. I need you to add brass to the fence and a brass to hold the blade in. And if you can do that, I think we're golden. So I come home and, you know, shook this thing around for a little while and finally sent him a couple examples, and bam, there it is. But what's funny is what I did was I'd put this thing together and I'd give it to my son, which was, I think he was around 6 years old at the time. And I said, now throw it across the shop and let's see if it falls apart. And that was kind of my test. Yep. If that sucker could survive my son throwing it across the shop, bouncing off the floor, off the wall, and then back on the floor again, I thought I had a pretty decent, decent tool. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the way that thing was torture tested in the beginning. But it's so if you compare it to what the original was, it's not even the same tool. And that's pretty much what the original manufacturer said when we showed them to him. And so when we got his blessing, that kind of made it feel better. And went from there. But that's kind of where it started. That was in 2008 when I changed. That was the finish, the fit, the custom knob that it has today, mm-hmm. So on and so forth. That's kind of where it all came from.
Well, that's cool. So, I mean, so what did you start with? What was the first gauge you started with? Was it?
It was the 4-inch marking gauge, which was the original gauge was only 3 inches. It was mm-hmm. a 3-inch fence with a 3-inch beam, but it just didn't feel right when you got a hold of it. It was way too thin. I think mm-hmm. his was like a 3/8 of an inch thick, so it felt way too delicate, and so we blew it up. And I went to a 4-inch beam. That's the reason it's called a 4-inch marking gauge.
Right.
That happened so long ago that it just stuck. But
yeah,
you know, it doesn't really make sense because it's talking about the length of the beam instead of the width of the fence.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't even have anything to do with the depth of cut. So it's kind of in a way confusing. But it's better than calling it large and small. And so, I mean, that's kind of where we're at, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly, yeah.
So it kind of gives it a dimension in one way, but it's really that 4-inch gauge is really talking about the length of the beam.
Beam.
And the fence, itself is 3 inches wide, which is double a wheel gauge. Mm-hmm. And so that's where that reference, you add the width of the fence, the blade itself, it just tracks so well across the edge. That's the secret of that gauge.
Yeah. And, yeah. Yeah. I agree when using your gauge versus the wheel gauge that I have. Yeah, exactly. It's
now I will say I use a wheel gauge for making my tools.
Mm-hmm.
I use it in my traditional gauge. There are no one gauge will do every job. It's mm-hmm. not possible.
Right.
That's what I found in the 15 plus years that I've been making them.
Mm-hmm.
While one gauge excels at marking dovetails, another gauge excels at laying out hinges.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stuff like that. There's just so many different things. People will buy a tool like a marking gauge and expect it to do every job, and it really can't.
No.
Some of them will, like I say, will exceed at a dovetail or a mortise and tenon joint or so on and so forth.
Need multiples too, because yes. You got to leave them set for a certain
dimension. And that's what I found.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's kind of what's unique about me selling different species. You might have a Osage orange gauge, which is bright yellow when it leaves my shop. If you leave it in the bag, it'll stay that way. But if you leave it out, if you leave it out on the bench, it's going to be like a golden brown in a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And then the bottom side's not going to match.
Mm-hmm.
They are so photosensitive, it's crazy. But I also have Cocobolo that when I machine it, it's the most ugly yellow, black, and purple stripes that you have ever seen. But when it sits in my shop for about 4 days, it turns into a red orange. Right? You never know what you're getting, right? So right. these woods are really, really unique. And thankfully, my customers are patient and will allow me to let things cook for a little while so I can see what they're going to do before I ship them out.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. If you got different colors of gauges, you could, okay, you know, the yellow one or the mustard one now is is set up for this particular dimension, you know, from whatever you're working on. My ebony one set up for this one. Yeah, exactly. Cocobolo for that. Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I have about 3 marking gauges, and I've done that too, but they're all different, so I know that.
Well, what you will find is you'll see a gauge may not fit into a certain
mm-hmm.
layout situation. It's kind of like what I ran into when I got into making them. My gauge had about 2.5 inches ahead of the blade, and so that really limits you on what you can lay out.
Mm-hmm.
If you get into anything that's got a shoulder, that 2.5 inches, just you're screwed. You can't do anything with that.
Yeah.
Where you step into like a wheel gauge that's 3/4 of an inch from the center, that's getting it down pretty good.
Yeah, you can work with that.
You know, so there's certain situations where, and while this gauge may be the best gauge out there, there's another one that might do the job a little better. So.
Yeah, everything has its limitations.
Yes.
And excels at certain things. So after you did the marking gauge, what was next up? I know you sell panel gauges too, as well as some.
I had a gentleman from the University of Memphis contact me back, I think it was 2010, about making a panel gauge. And the only panel gauge I could find on the internet was a 85.5. And I had seen the pictures. I'd never held one in my hand. And this gentleman wanted one with a 39-inch beam.
Yikes.
And I don't know if you guys have ever made a stick 7/8 in square, dead flat.
Flat, yeah. Ooh, yeah.
And not exactly. For very long. Not
and
for
make
sure.
It yeah. stay flat. Okay. So I worked and I worked and I worked. And that it was, I tried just a flat plate, you know, put a flat plate on the top. Tighten it down with a stud. Mm-hmm. I tried that. Everything I tried, the beam would rock left and right. I could make it not rise, you know, up and down, but it would it would always swing left and right.
Right.
Which to me was wrong. That's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of things happened to me in that in that period. I lost a daughter, which was, you know, horrible.
Yeah.
But we had taken a trip to California during the Christmas holiday just to get away from Northwest Arkansas. And one night, I think we had been out to Huntington Beach or something, and we were pretty much worn out. We had walked all day and had a really exhausting night. And I woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I told my wife, I got it. And she's like, you got what? I said, I know how to fix my panel gauge. She's like, go back to sleep. You know? And so I come home and I had figured out how to make the beam lock dead tight. And so I made the panel gauge. I got it to work. Everything was great. And so I made the first one. I shipped it off to the gentleman over in Memphis. And got a great response. Unbelievable tool. Thank you. So on and so forth. And so I made a couple more and just happened to have a Woodworking America conference that fall. And I took one with me. It just happened to be the same year that Lee Nielsen released their panel gauge. And Tom had come by my booth and actually picked that gauge up and walked off with it. And he had it. I think they had it for about 2.5 hours, maybe a little more before I got it back. And shortly after I got it back, Christopher Schwartz came by and looked at it. And he said, I tell you what, you cut that beam off to about 28 inches, make it to where I can hold a pencil in one end, and I think you got a product you can sell. And so I brought it home and I made that gauge and I sent it to Chris. Well, the next thing that happened, and you guys have probably talked about this before, is I got Schwartz.
Yes,
we have.
I don't do this as my only job. I work for a large telecommunications company as an engineer.
Okay.
But at the time, I was a splicer. And I was sitting in my splicing van, splicing fiber. And I thought it was cool to have this cash register ringtone for an email that was an order. I got so sick and tired of hearing that cash register. I didn't know what to do. Guys, I'll be honest. I didn't have the blades. I didn't have the wood. I didn't have the knobs. I didn't have the locking mechanism. I didn't have anything. And I sold 150 gauges that day.
Dang.
And I had no
idea. That's not the definition of a Schwarzing.
I had no idea what I was going to do. And so I come home and I talk to my wife and, you know, the only thing I could do was you got to act. And so I jumped on getting the blades. I jumped on getting the knobs and so on and so forth. And I found a really good guy to get the curly maple for me, the so on and so forth. And I think it was May. That was December 11th, 2011 when that happened. And it was around May when I dug out. And I was sick of making panel gauges, but I got so good at it that I hated to lose, you know, that rhythm, because you kind of build up a rhythm to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty awesome. But what happened in that same show, a gentleman had picked up one of my little marking gauges and he'd said, do you have anything more substantial? These are kind of dainty, which got the old wheels turning. Right. And so, I had thought about the traditional marking gauge. And so while working those huge orders of panel gauges, my router had grabbed one of my panel gauges and just ate it. I mean, just destroyed it. And so I got so mad, I threw it down on the ground. It bounced up, went through one of the panes of glass in my window. And I still have that hanging on my wall to this day. I'm standing there. My wife walks up. I'd already cut my finger on trying to get the glass. Each one of my paint, it's like 9 individual panes of glass in these windows. And
okay,
so I was able to just pop this thing out. And I'd already had the glass the whole 9 yards. But I'm sitting there. I'm getting it all dug out. And she walks over to me. She says, what's wrong? I said, Well, I got mad and I threw a gauge down. It bounced up, went through this damn window, and you know, the whole nine yards. And while I'm sitting there, I go back in and I pick that thing up and I look at it and I go, well, heck, if I knock 2 inches off the other end, I got a marking gauge. And so, no shit, that's how it came about, guys. And so I just shrunk everything down to where it would be a marking gauge. And the first guy I took it to was Don McConnell and Larry Williams with Old Street Tools. Mm-hmm. They live really close to me.
Right.
And they had taken I had got invited over to do a little demonstration at their shop. And when I went over there, my shop's not that big. It's just a 24x36 building, fairly small in my opinion. I go over there and there's these two guys that make some of the most exquisite tools I've ever seen in my life, working in a basement of an old Victorian home in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. Their benches were so close that if they rolled back and forth, they were bumping each other's backs, right?
Right.
And I was embarrassed because I have this big building that I make these tools in, and they're over there making stuff that made mine look like junk toys, right? And they're in this little bitty closet compared to what I'm in, and it's like, wow. But man, they took my marking gauge and tore it apart. I mean, it was like, oh God, I didn't feel like I had an ass left when I left. So, but those guys have been so inspirational to me that it's unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from everything from heat treating a blade to make it perform at its highest, to the way to sharpen it, so on and so forth, has come through those two guys. So I have to throw a lot of the credit for my business that way.
Right. That's great. So what do you use for a finish on your gauges?
I use a 3-part finish.
Okay.
It's tung oil, turpentine, and spar varnish.
Okay.
I apply that and I let it dry for 24 hours. And then it goes to a buffing machine. And that's one of the first things Dave Jeske taught me was how to make this buffing machine. And I had a 2-horse motor.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a 3/4-inch shaft, 3 foot long. I got 4 buffing wheels on it, 12 inches in diameter. And you start with a Tripoli, white diamond, wax, and then buff. And so it goes through every one of those steps. Here's the problem. You got brass in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so brass on all your dark woods, walnut, so on and so forth, it's not a problem. It's not an issue.
Right.
As soon as you step into maple, you just set a fire. And so what happens on that is brass has a tendency to go black, especially when it's buffed.
Uh-huh.
And so the first thing you're going to do is drag that black right down that beautiful curly maple. And there's no way to keep it from it. And so there's techniques that I have to do to keep that from doing that. And it gets really... gets stressful at times when you say that.
Yes.
But it's techniques you have to learn. But I've got a homemade.
Oh, so that's one of the curly maples, a little bit more expensive than the other ones.
It's actually, you know, when the rosewoods went, to CITES II,
mm-hmm.
and to where you can't import any more rosewoods. The rosewoods and ebonies all went up.
Yeah.
And that's because it went from, you can make, you know, not getting too deep, but if you're just doing a cherry walnut gauge, your material cost is a lot cheaper than if you're looking at an African blackwood.
Right.
An African blackwood, you're looking at material wise, almost $12 in just material just to make this little bitty gauge.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't think about that. But it's when you're dealing with this, a lot of the wood you get is junk to begin with. You got to get rid of all the checks and, you know, splits and everything just to make a tool. It's really, really hard to do. Mm-hmm. And that's why those woods cost more than what like a cherry gauge does.
Oh no, it makes it makes perfect.
It makes. I mean, when you see it, when you see what happens, yeah, you can just peel cherry off the edge, right? You're just hammering them dudes out, and then someone sends you this piece of I want a marking gauge out of Brazilian rosewood, and man, you get that thing, and you just paid $700 for a piece of wood, and you're about to put it in a table saw. And your butt just clenches up like a, you know, it's just like, man, I am scared to death to even turn this saw on. And I got to run this piece of wood into it. And so, you know, you pucker up. And there's nothing worse. I remember the first time I bought a piece of African blackwood. It was 2 inches thick, 5.5 inches wide, and about 50 inches long. I paid $950 for that.
Whoa.
And I was about to run it into a table saw. and I was about to cry because I didn't know what to do. And am I going to get any return out of it? Yeah. I mean, it was pretty, it makes it kind of nervous. Especially when you're a beginning tool maker. That was really, really hard to do.
Yeah.
That's kind of where that stuff came from, and that's kind of why tools differ from a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
My standard marking gauges, like domestic woods, they're all kept low for one reason, and that's Mark Adams students. Mm. And I've kept it that way for almost 15 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we do that. But those other woods, they're a different story. They're kind of, they're almost priced per the ounce. Mm-hmm. And it's sad. Wow. Man, these things, some of these woods are getting so hard to get. Mm-hmm. or good pieces that they're going to keep getting higher.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
That's sad.
Mm-hmm.
It's really sad.
Well, I think I have your ebony one, so I'm glad I picked that up when I did several years ago.
Jeff, you mentioned when you went to the guys at Old Street and they, you know, they just shredded your marking gauge. Like, how did you take that as constructive versus, you know, defeatist? Well, I mean, I think I had a moment like that in my bench making, and, you know, it was a really important moment, but you have to take it the right way.
Yeah, I tell you, to be honest, that was a two. It was a good cop, bad cop experience. Larry grabbed my hand and took me and showed me what I needed to fix. Don grabbed the hammer and hit me just slap in the jaw. This thing sucks, and I don't see how you can freaking sell it. You know, but if it wasn't for that, I don't think I would have came home and did what I did. I'm talking from the now I pretty much have a friction fit on the beam, to where when you're sliding that through that sliding dovetail, there is no slop left and right. If there is, it doesn't leave my shop. Then you step over into Larry, and Larry's whole thing was about the blade. The blade was not hard. It was, guys, I was so green at that time. I thought tempered mean the dang thing was hardened and ready to go. No, that just means it was tempered.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to replace a bunch of blades and so on and so forth up until, you know, it was probably several hundred that I had to replace because I didn't know that the knives weren't hard. They were just tempered. And so the guys were using these blades, and after about 3 or 4 strokes, they were dull. And so we had to, you know, I had to replace those blades and so on and so forth. And so it was a huge learning experience. But those two guys took me, and that experience was, like Mark was saying, it's kind of like, how did you handle it? I handled it better than I thought I would. That creative criticism, like one guy was helping me, but the other one was berating me really bad. It really helped. I think it made me come home and really dig deep inside and decide what I needed to do to make the tool right. And really, in all honesty, do I want to even continue doing what I was doing? And So it took a lot of soul searching, and fortunately, I came out of it on top. And but that experience right there was probably as much the turning point as meeting Dave in the Woodworking America conference.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean,
I've got a gauge from maybe 5 years ago or so, and there's zero play.
Yeah.
Between the arm and the fence.
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to do. What's the timeline between you meeting with those guys and Dave?
It was probably within the same year.
Okay.
It was in that same time period. Because in all honesty, when I first started my business, here's why I started it for. Mm-hmm. If I could make enough money to pay for my tuition the next year, I thought I was a successful company. Uh-huh. So I was looking at sales of less than 50 units per year, and I was happy.
Yep.
And when I met Dave and Larry and Don, that it had to be the same year because I met them up there at the school.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So when I met them, and my business, you can see it by the tracking. It went from less than $3,000 a year to off the charts, if you will, you know, wow, compared to that. And it was all because of what they did. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guidance I got from those guys was unbelievable. You know, I couldn't have done it without them. Because getting into the tool making world is difficult. No one wants to work with a small. If you go to a machine shop and you only want 25, 50 blades, forget it. There's no one gonna set up a milling machine to cut 25 blades for a guy, right?
Yeah.
It's just not economical.
Yeah, Kyle, you know anything about that? About
No. I've only been trying to get this reamer made for about a year and a half now.
You know, I've always thought if this marking gauge thing flops, I'm going to start a machine shop for toolmakers.
Because
no one will do this stuff for you, right? So
no.
That's what I have found.
You a price to go away.
Yeah. So when you start doing this at a, you know, and kind of see what it takes per hour to do what you do, you kind of see where they're coming from. But man, I couldn't believe when I approached my first company, I needed 1,000 knobs and 1,000 blades, and holy crap, I got that, and I was like, what do I do if I can't sell these, right? Yep. So
yeah, no, I'm right there with you. I mean,
you know, that's one of the scariest things you can go through right there.
Oh yeah.
Is your first big purchase on a material, man. That's really scary. And I think, my first knob order was 2,500 units. And, I didn't know, I mean, it took every bit of money I had made for the whole year, I think, just to buy those knobs. And I was terrified because I didn't
sinking all my fortune into knobs.
And what's bad is the guy had made these knobs. They didn't know what the heck he was doing. And I get all of them. I had to refinish them when I got them anyway. Mm. And it's like, man, this just pisses me off to pay so much money for this and then have to do all this work, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what's really, I think that holds back a lot of our woodworking tool design, if you will, because someone may have a really good idea, but it is so expensive to get it to market. It is unbelievable.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is. Yeah.
You know that by your jigs, right? So,
yeah, I mean, this all metal reamer that I wanted to produce. And, you know, luckily I teamed up with Sean, who already had somebody that can make these things out there. And, but without that, I live in the heart of the oil and gas industry in, the Gulf Coast of Texas. And, you know, I can throw a stone and hit three machine shops, but not a one of them is going to give me the time of day.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what I ran into. You know, I can't go to any of my local machine shops and get anything done.
Yeah.
Everything I have done has been off the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a shame. I would love to go back to that first machine shop and laugh at that guy. I really would. At the business he lost.
Look what you missed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he'd probably laugh at like, you're only doing like, you know, X amount of dollars. But still, it would just, it's sad that there's no one to really work with us that much. And so the tool makers like myself, that's one of the hidden battles we work that people really don't ever see is, you know, how do we source our parts? And some of us make everything. And those guys, man, I give kudos to, because it's hard enough doing what I do. But some of these guys that make every single individual part of their tool, man, wow, you got it going, dude. And that's huge right there. That's just absolutely huge part of the tool making business.
Right. Now, well, stepping a little bit away from the tool making business. So you originally got in this because you were a fan of woodworking. So do you do any actual woodworking anymore?
And the only woodworking I do is make panel gauges, additional marking gauges.
You made some chairs.
I did make chairs. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah. That,
chairs. You know, and
but
and
you speaking, basically speaking, have to take a vacation to do some woodwork.
Let me tell you something about that little vacation. So we do this vacation thing, right? And we're all going to go, and instead of doing this woodworking show, we're going to go build something. And so they take me off to this chair shop, you know, there's nothing worse than taking a tool maker and throwing him into a chair shop. So I'm used to dealing in thousands of an inch. And when you're dealing with woodworking, that sounds stupid, but a thousandth of an inch can make that beam slide left and right or where you can't even feel it. And so if I over surface that bevel 2/1000ths of an inch, I have to throw it away. It goes in my fire pile.
Mm-hmm.
And so you take me and then throw me into a chair shop where there is no dimension.
Yeah.
And I am lost. I am completely lost. So it was a lot of fun. I'm glad I got into it.
Yeah.
I wish that my shop had enough room to where I could have one of Mark's shave horses in it at all times. So I could just, there's nothing more relaxing than just sitting down on a shave horse and dimensioning spindles. I mean, honestly, it's unbelievable.
You get into a zone. I mean,
it's unbelievable. And I just fell in love with it. I so wish that I could just take a day and just say, I'm not making gauges. I'm not making knives. I'm just going to do spindles today. And, you know, we had the most awesome instructor in Greg Pennington in the world. The guy was so patient. It was unbelievable. But making chairs is something that, I got to do. I get drawn into it, and I'm ready to go build more, but, it's just,
Well, to that vein, you do have your Hamilton spindle gauge, which is fantastic. And it's always right on my shave horse the time. So,
you know, that thing, I was out riding my bike that day. And Greg had sent out this post, and I don't know why I looked at my dang phone, but I picked up my phone. I guess it buzzed or something, and I had it in the back of my jersey. And so I pull it out and I look, and Greg had sent this picture of that spindle gauge, but in plywood. And I had remembered, you know, Mark and I and Chris Keen, we all made one of these while we were there, and we had to drill these holes in, and you know, after so many spindles, that hole would wallow out, and you'd have to drill another one, right? And so it was all the time you're having to drill another hole to make sure your spindles were sized right, and so on and so forth. And so I don't know what it was, but man, I just stopped and I called Greg and I said, hey, I got an idea. I'll make this thing out of aluminum to where we don't have to drill them damn holes again, and let's see how this thing works. And so I sent it to him. And of course, I drew every, I cut all the holes accurate, which
right.
was wrong. You can't do that because
be
then
a little bit. Yeah.
Is you see what I'm saying? If yeah. you drill, if you made it so accurate that the wood, when you put it in the gauge, if it fit, you've already went too far.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So
we discovered that with the continuous arm rocker I just painted.
Yes, we did.
I have one of those early gauges in my shop.
Yes, you do. And so what we found was you want to oversize by 20/1000ths of an
right.
inch. Yep. That way, when you get it, when it fits in the gauge, you still have scraper room. Mm-hmm. And so that was the secret of that. And it took, oh man, I couldn't tell you how many trips back and forth of me sending gauges back and forth to Greg's shop to where we finally got it zeroed in. And yeah. That was pretty cool because one of the, you know, I told him, I said, well, okay, I'm going to send them off to get anodized. And he says, well, if you anodize them,
yeah,
then they're not going to leave, then they're not going to leave that mark. And yeah. I said, so just leave them naturally.
Oh, yeah, the burnished, yeah, the aluminum burnish mark. Yeah, that's
well, right. Well, it doesn't burnish. Right. It changes colors on the
yeah,
wood.
Yeah, it makes a little black mark on
yeah.
it.
So, yeah, so.
Plus, it changes the diameter of the hole.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, 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 the anodizing wood, yeah, it makes
yeah.
it smaller.
It's not a lot,
yeah.
but it would change it some. So then we'd be back at the, you know, back at the drawing board again. But, you know, that wouldn't have been hard to figure out. But the simple fact of when you rub that aluminum on the white oak, it leaves that nice black line.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is scrape that off and you're dead on. That's what's nice.
Yeah.
And that's pretty unique about that tool. Yeah. And I love
yeah,
that.
I noticed thing. You also made it in a metric. So
yes.
Who's your, I assume,
you know,
Australia?
Well, Glenn Rundle was the one supposed to
okay.
pick that up, and
okay.
it just didn't go very good. I don't know what
oh,
happened
really?
Over there.
Yeah, because you know, I'm looking at my jigs, you know, obviously I sell them, most of them to the U.S., but and I've sold them, you know, to a number of different countries, but, you know, out of all the countries besides the U.S., Australia has to be the biggest.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah. Australia and Germany are my two biggest out
okay.
of the States.
Yeah,
yeah. So. I ship more shave horse kits to Australia than I do any other country besides
isn't
the U.S. I mean,
isn't
more
that
than
crazy?
Wow. Yeah, that yeah. Crazy. Same with my jigs. Yeah.
Yeah. But and it's I don't know if there's a like a classic hand tools from Great Britain. I've not heard of one in Australia. If there is one, hey, someone reach out, let me know. But yeah.
I don't know. I think it's just there are so many fine chair makers in Australia. I think it just kind of, I don't know. I think besides the U.S., they probably have more, you know, teachers and students and people getting into it than anywhere else
I think
in the world.
Right. But yeah. I of all the international tool sales that I have, Australia is probably number one.
Yeah.
And that's everything. Knives, gauges, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of shocking, but
yeah, we didn't even talk about your Marky knife. So you do have some Marky knives out there.
That's a new creature. I found what happened was there's an instructor up at Mark Adams called his name is Stephen Proctor.
Mm-hmm.
He showed us how to make a knife back in the I can't even remember what year it was, probably 06, 07, somewhere around in there. And in that class, we took a 3/4 inch bandsaw blade and ground the gussets off of it,
mm-hmm.
The teeth off of it, down to the gusset. And then we just, you know, took a router and maybe we didn't even, I can't remember what we used. But we made a pocket for it to fit into two pieces of wood and we glued it all together, right? And then, because you're going to use this knife for the rest of the class once you're finished with it. Which was pretty unique, but we took that and then ground it to 60 degrees, you know, or 50 degree point, and then 60 degree bevel, and so on and so forth, and the ends had to be curved like a quill because he's kind of eccentric anyway. And so I've had this knife laying around in my shop since that time. I was like, you know, I use this thing daily, and what's really nice about it is it don't roll off my table.
Yeah.
And I really like that. And so I had kind of batted this thing around, and I remember taking one of these to one of Mark and I's and Chris Keene's chair making vacations, if you will, and kind of showed it off at that class, but I didn't have it heat treated. I just had the knife made it kind of in its form and just wanted them to try it out. And it, if you look at it, it looks a lot like a carpenter's pencil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that came from. Its shape is so simple, but so daggum hard to make that it's elementary. And yeah. The sheath itself, it's only there to protect the blade. But
that is unique to have the sheath on there. Yes.
But the whole thing is designed around, because I built it from the ground up based on, there's one thing that all knives got to have, especially with a complex grind. It has to have a way to sharpen it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I had found in all my travels, picking up people's marking knives, everyone's marking knife generally has what I would call an oval tip. And so instead of being a straight 50-degree bevel, if you will, it's rounded in an oval shape, because the natural tendency when you're trying to hone something, it rocks, because mm-hmm. you're on a short bevel anyway. And so what I thought was, when I make this knife, it has to have a honing guide to go with it. And so I said, we've got it pretty close. We're almost ready to release it. I use one pretty much daily. It just doesn't look that nice. And so yes. I can't really, you know, it's not marketable in its current condition.
It's and a proof of concept, as I call it.
Yes, exactly. It works. It works perfectly. Yeah. Yeah. But I've got to make it to where, you know, people like you are going to talk about it.
Yeah, someone might actually buy it. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So that's where the whole thing is. That's what's nice about this knife is the jig that I'm talking about will clamp in any Eclipse style honing guide, Lee Valley. Lee Nielsen's gate, honing guide, things like that. It'll clamp in that. And there'll be an index line on the back where you line it up with the fence. Once you put your knife in, everything's set. And all you do is stroke it a few times on your stones, and you're back in business. And
now, would this sharpen any type of spear point?
As long as it's 16th of an inch thick.
Okay.
I think if it went over just a little bit, I think it would still work okay.
Okay.
But if you got under it, that's when the difficulty would come in.
Okay.
That's when I would have to make different thicknesses. Yeah. And that's always a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think I'm going to make a knife that's got a little bit thinner blade for the guys that can't. that, you know, you got those people that have to make dovetails that are so, well, you got to have a Japanese saw to even cut the kerf, right?
Right.
So, you got those guys. So you're going to have a knife that's so thin that it's almost non-existent.
Yeah.
So that may come out in the future. I don't know. I do have other ideas on the knife. Mark knows about it. He's kind of been after me about one type of knife for like 3 years now.
At this point, I'd be happy just for the honing guide. I'm sitting here sharpening one of your knives right now. And
I know. I'm sorry.
Cursing your inability to get the marking gauge, the honing guide out.
Shade thrown.
It's like I said, here's what happens. When you take this honing guide and you put a knob in it, and you got to be thinking about a cap that's going to hold a blade flat reference-wise, and you're going to lift this clamping device up, what kind of complex angles are we looking at now? It is off the charts, and I'm getting into quantum physics. So I will get it. It's just going to take me just a little bit, but
yeah,
the what happens is you try, you know, anytime you're making a new tool or whatever, mm-hmm. you make something and it fails, let's say. Hopefully it fails in your shop before you release it to anybody. But it fails, and then you get a little disheartened about it, and you go in and throw some things and so on and so forth, and you discuss and discuss it. And then you come back and you try it again until you get it right. But that's kind of where I'm at. And so I know what works. It's just not as marketable as something, you know, I envision this lever cap like a really nice Lee Nielsen plane or a Lee Valley or Veritas, excuse me, plane cap, you know, something like that. I'm not really looking for a Holte or anything, but,
right.
you know, something looks really nice, but yeah. something that I can include with the knife, because my knives are expensive, but they're, the reason being is the labor involved. They're extremely, you know, something that looks so simple. How can it be that expensive? It's the labor involved in it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's no different than any other type of quote unquote knife.
Yes.
And if you look at it in that aspect, it's extremely competitive and reasonable,
yes.
you know, for anybody else's, you know, whether it be, you know, like a butt type knife or even a fine chef's knife. It's in the same ballpark.
I was looking at some because I'd like to, the deal with the surface grinder is mm-hmm. a little secret out here. I'm going to try to get into to some Damascus steels.
Ooh,
and
nice.
So when you start looking at that, yeah. you know, I get the Damascus blades, and those things are like $30, $40 a piece. They're not even touched.
Mm-hmm.
They're not even flat.
Right.
So they got to be surface ground, you know, they got to be made to my tolerance. And
do you have to like etch that stuff afterwards?
Yeah. So you're like, whoo, that stuff's going to be crazy. But it's just, man, I got to do it because that's just the coolest crap I've ever seen. you know, I can't imagine seeing these different patterns of, you know, like a feather or whatever.
Right.
pattern on this layout knife. That's just going to be cool. So I've got to do it. And exactly. it's kind of like stainless steel. I didn't really want to step into that because brass you can work with woodworking tools.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's soft. It's right. easy to work with. Right. But man, when you step into a steel, run a router bit into a stainless steel piece.
No,
happens there, boys. That's not fun. So it's different. I do make knives with stainless steel bollards, but I don't really charge any more for them, but they're really hard to make.
Yeah. And,
I didn't really know how different it was until I ran it into my engraver. I have this really nice engraver the point is one thou.
Wow.
1/1000th of an inch, right? And so, it wasn't 1/1000 when I ran it through that stainless. It was like 20/1000. So you kind of figure out real quick that, man, hey, this stuff's kind of different.
Yeah.
And, you know, it takes a different animal to work it. And that's, that's just part of the tool making experience. You're always learning, thankfully. Mm-hmm. That's what keeps me interested in it. You never know, you know, you get a different piece of wood, just got a piece of olive in for a customer. He's wanting a gauge from every port that he's been in. He's in the Navy
mm-hmm.
and getting ready to retire. And he wanted a layout knife and a marking gauge from every port that he's been in. That's a bunch. And so I had to order all these woods. And so I got like this Jara Burl from Australia and some Grecian olive and some other things. And man, this olive is just some of the most beautiful stuff I've ever seen in my life.
Yep.
And that in itself keeps me going because I get to see things that most woodworkers will never get to see, you know, and it, in exotic woods and some things like that. And it's really, really neat. I really like that part of the woodworking or the tool making side of woodworking.
Well, that is cool. Well, So is there anything else coming up for you?
Now, no, I don't have anything else. I'm always open to different things.
Right.
But, you know, it's like the panel gauge. I had no intention of making that thing.
Right.
It never crossed my mind, but someone out of the blue contacted me to make it. And no one else would make this tool for this guy. And it was like, okay, I'll take on the challenge. I'll see what I can do. I'm always open to stuff like that. It's like the Jenny Alexander gauge that I made. That a gentleman contacted me to make that. And those kind of tools, I love making custom tools. Kieran Benny from the UK, he wanted a traditional marking gauge with a 12-inch beam. Something custom, you know, something you just pick up off the shelf. And I love doing stuff like that. You know, stuff that not everybody will make for you. I like to do that.
Yeah. And he's a cool guy. He's on our podcast, about 6 months ago or so. Maybe
not. Yeah, he's a really neat guy.
Yeah, he's fantastic. Well, with that, why don't we say we move into our fortnightly beer choices?
You're here.
And I'll start off. I'm still drinking the Christmas ale. I'm still drinking the. I'm going back and forth. In fact, I had both varieties tonight, and that would be the St. Arnold's Christmas ale as well as the Carbach. You'll shoot your eye out. I figure I got at least another 2 months. I can keep drinking the Christmas ales.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have any of the Shiner?
No, I haven't got any of the Shiner. We like those other two so much. I should probably.
Yeah, no. I mean, I had them when I was down there. They're very good.
We buy them a case at a time. So, but anyway. So, Sean, what are you drinking?
So, I picked up just recently, just happened to be, it was more on the Christmas holiday, but I found a Founders release of their 2020 KBS, which is their Kentucky bourbon stout. This one happens to be flavored with maple Mackinac fudge, which if you're not around the Midwest, or I would even say the tri-state Indiana, Michigan, Ohio area, you may not know about Mackinac fudge, but it's well known.
I might have to get you to ship me some of that. My mom loves the fudge.
Okay. And
I like it, but
I've got to find it because it's not like it's readily available around me. Yeah. I mean, Mackinac is a good 5-hour drive.
Does the beer have a fudgy flavor?
Yeah. It had that chocolatey flavor to it, which is crazy.
That's cool.
Because it's just a, I don't know how they flavor it. I'm assuming they tossed it into the mash or something.
Mm-hmm.
but very good. I mean, and their KBS, their stuff. I mean, it's aged. It's an aged stout, so you can guarantee. I think it comes in somewhere near 9% or so. So, you know. Oh no, I take it back. 11%. So.
Oh yeah.
That's good beer.
Exactly. That's good. 11%.
Yeah. That's a good.
Yeah, and not quite up to a good 14%er, but hey, you're working there.
Well, no, and to say that, so like KBS is something that normally is an annual release. And so in a shelf here in my basement, I've got 18, 19, and now a little bit of 20. And so, I'm letting this stuff age. And so,
what was that stuff? Sam Adams, I don't know if they still do it, but they used to put out like this special beer once a year. It was like $100 or bottle or something.
Yeah, my uncle. It wasn't a Magnum. No. My uncle had it one. It was a cobalt thing. And it was sold in a cobalt bottle. So
it was like 20% or something like that.
The blue tone at it, yeah. And I was underage when my uncle had it. But he let me have a sip of it. And that stuff was so syrupy. He poured it into a clear glass. And when you tip the glass, it stained the glass red. It was just so thick. And boozy as hell and just wild. 20 or more percent. I have no idea. But it was one of those things, like, at the time, you couldn't get it in Ohio. He went out of state to get it. because it was not allowable because of whatever regulations were in
place. Yeah, Utopia, I think what it is.
Yeah, that might have been it. That might have been it, yeah.
I was just looking it up. It's aged for like 24 years.
Yeah, and it's like in this I Dream of Jeannie bottle, you know?
Like, yeah,
Sam Adams? Is that the Sam Adams?
Yeah, Sam Adams.
Yeah, it's like a steel. It's like one of those, I forgot what they called, the copper
and steel. You have to get on a waiting list to even get a bottle.
Yeah. It was a big deal that my uncle had it back in the day.
Yeah, it's 28%.
I mean, come on.
It's like wine.
Yeah, it's basically it's high more test than wine. I mean, it's not wine, a bunch of booze.
Mead. That's better than that. That's better than that Dogfish Head you and I had, Mark.
I still have three bottles of that. If you're ready.
What Dogfish? What do you got?
The 120 minute.
Oh yeah, 120. Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah.
That's some good stuff right there.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're into the IPAs, I mean, it is good.
It's got too much going on for me. I stop at the 90 minute.
Well, so if Diami, you know, would ever talk to you about Dogfish Head, he'll tell you, here's the thing to do. You take a 60 and a 90 and you pour half of each into two glasses and you make your own 75.
And that's the one.
And that's the way to go. They sell 75, but they sweeten it.
I didn't know that.
Like, with corn syrup or something. And so it's different. But he said that's the middle mix and it's a little more tolerable. The 120, my wife loves 120. We've had 120, but we can handle about one of them.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah,
I can't even split a bottle. It's too much. It's grippy and it's, I just don't enjoy it.
I remember back when we could go out, one of my favorite beer joints around here had that on tap, 120. I went
120 on tap.
120 on tap, and I went.
It never goes bad.
Yeah, and I went, oh man, I want that so bad, but you know, it's like 30 miles from my house. I have to drive.
Wow.
Yeah, but I was just like, oh man, I probably missed it, but anyway, but hopefully we can go out sometime.
Yeah, one day.
One day.
One day.
One day. So Mark, what are you drinking?
I've got a Boulevard Brewing Cosmic Camper IPA.
Okay. Cosmic Boulevard's Camper. Good. That sounds interesting.
It's just a weird IPA made in Kansas City.
Cool. Nice. So Jeff, do you have anything to recommend?
Well, I like I like to call a dirty tool maker. It's a Sam Adams Boston Lager and a good Lord, you made me forget. Guinness stout.
Oh, okay. A little black and tan then.
You're familiar with a black and tan.
Oh yeah.
I like to make what I call a dirty tool maker.
Okay.
And that comes in really handy when you're sanding.
Yeah.
We call it woodworking fluid around here. You just pour it just like you would a black and tan, and they're unbelievable. I love them. And that's currently what I'm having right now. Yes.
I will have to try that. I've had black and tans of different varieties. I've never combined a Boston Lager and a Guinness.
Just remember it's a dirty tool maker.
I will call it as much.
Did you custom make a little tool to pour the Guinness over the?
You know, I can do that. I find a tablespoon works just fine though.
Do you do that? I mean, it's like absinthe where you pour it over a spoon.
Yeah, you have to, and it's amazing. I still don't understand how the heck it does it, but the Sam Adams sits on the bottom and the Guinness sits on the top, and it's like, dang, that's cool. And so the first time I had to show my wife, and she's, you know, she doesn't really care, but she goes, yeah, that's all right, as I walk out the door to the shop. But that's my beer of choice. I like to have the Guinness and the Sam Adams together.
Yeah,
that's not bad.
It's the best of both.
I might go to the store tomorrow and grab some.
Yeah,
that sounds really good.
Yeah, I went. That reminds me, in college we used to always get the pitcher of beer and whatever the cheapest one was, and then we'd pour a bottle of Guinness into it.
Oh yeah,
really?
Yeah.
See, and we used to get 151 and drop a shot into whatever beer we had.
There you go.
Well, that's a car bomb, basically.
Yeah, that's exactly. A car bomb.
Yep.
It just didn't matter if it was Milwaukee's Best or Miller or who cared. It was just let's make them more alcoholic.
Yep. Well, anyway. Well, with that said, let's move on to where folks can find us on the interweb. So, Jeff, what about you? Where can folks find you?
They can find me at jeff@hamiltontools.com for email.
Uh-huh.
And hamiltontools.com is my website. And on Instagram, I'm GageMaker1.
Fantastic. Mark, what about yourself?
I am on the internet at plate11.com. I am on Instagram at markbuildsit. And I am on YouTube at plate11woodworking. Sean, how about you?
There you go. I'm SeanW78 on pretty much most places you can find me on the interweb. Kyle, how about you?
Well, before I do that, by the way, you're doing a great job, Mark, on the YouTube.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, Thanks. I saw your latest episode, I guess, a week or so ago. Yeah, it was great.
Good.
I loved it, Mark.
Did you fall asleep?
I did not.
I'm trying to make a cool and calm, so, you know, it's like an enjoyable, laid-back watching experience. So if you fall asleep, that's okay. It's an acceptable side effect.
It's the ASMR.
It gives you a reason to watch it again. It's good for my viewership.
I can't believe I told you that.
Oh, boy.
Well, with that, you can always find me at Barton.Kyle on Instagram, the only social media platform that matters. And with that, that just about wraps it up for this show. So if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on the podcatcher of your choice. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. And while you're there, please leave us a review.
Yeah, and thanks for listening. You can always follow us on Instagram at MWA_podcast. And the best thing you can do, though, is tell a friend, because word of mouth goes a long way in sharing our discussion.